Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Kathleen Berry about masculinity in war. Also, Dr. Carhart changes offices and gets a bunch of new protesters. And the Smithsonian caves into demands made by homophobes who are better ignored. Megan Carpentier talked all things Palin to me last week. She was also on MSNBC talking mom and daughter Palin.
I think everybody does have a book, but when you look at the book that she's written, she's done two things. And one is that she's really put herself in competition with Obama. The book is mostly attacking a lot of the positions that Obama has taken, but it doesn't really give independent voters or even GOP voters who are concerned about her credentials and concerned about some of the positions she's taking anything to really grab on and say, okay, this resolves my concerns.
My feelings right now are that Sarah Palin is painting herself into a corner where the only people that really like her are rabid anti-choicers. And they're not really enough of a constituency to swing a nationwide election. But a lot could change in the next 2 years. Dr. Leroy Carhart is one of the few abortion providers in the country to specialize in late-term abortions. He spent most of his career in Nebraska. He worked with Dr. George Tiller before Dr. Tiller was assassinated and vowed to carry on Dr. Tiller's work after the murder. Nebraska, in a show of extreme tastelessness, then passed a law aimed at basically shutting down Dr. Carhart's ability to perform medically necessary late-term abortions. But Dr. Carhart's patients need help, and he's moving his practice to Maryland so they can get it. And that means the protesters are getting all excited. I found an excellent YouTube video of the demonstrations, both for and against Dr. Carhart. A UCC pastor was thankfully out to show his support for Dr. Carhart.
Because I know a major part of my ministry has been working with women, counseling women as they're going through these decisions. I have never met someone who makes any of these decisions casually. I have never met someone who makes this decision without really thinking about what is going to be best for her, for her family, for the life that God is calling her to. And I think that there is a need to protect that option, to protect the ability of people to decide what a woman is going to do with her body and how she is going to be called to be reproductive in her life. And I think that there's a need to defend that right and defend the rights of women and families to make responsible choices about when they are ready to be parents.
If anything, this point of view is more important when it comes to late-term abortions. Most early-term abortions are done because the woman in question isn't ready to have a baby right then, and often the decision is completely private. But a woman having a late-term abortion is often making the decision in a context where she was intending to have the baby, and then something goes wrong. So the decision involves her family and her friends to a much larger extent than earlier abortions often do. I really liked this guy, too, because he was quickly able to dispense with the red herring question of when does life begin?
Thank you. I think the question is much more, when is family ready to receive life? When is a community ready to welcome new life into it? Asking the question of when does life begin is the wrong question. Asking the question of when are we ready to provide the space and the support that is needed to welcome new life, that's the question we talked about.
I was tickled to see later in the video that a woman was interviewing an extremely angry protester. Why tickled? Well, after watching for a few seconds, I realized the woman was Amanda Hess of TBD, who was doing some reporting on her blog about interviewing the protesters.
And somebody should be disgusted enough to stand up and say something about it. You know what I'm saying? And one thing about it, you know, so I don't have no shame when it comes to the truth. Because even the Bible tells you the truth makes you free. You know what I'm saying? To sit up and say that this is right, that's a lie from the pits of hell. That's just what it is. And these people doing this stuff, that's where they're going. They're going straight to hell. They're going to burn in hell for doing something like this. You see, Pharaoh used to do the same thing back in the day, killing children and throwing them to the alligators. know what I'm saying?
I linked her report in show notes. She has a really good breakdown of the different kinds of people who show up to these sorts of things. A combination of young people who are extremely ignorant, middle-aged men with all sorts of rage issues aimed at younger women, and women who show up to punish other women for being sexually active. There's also a side dose of investment in the idea that sexual liberation is foisted on women and that women can't actually be assumed to be moral agents who make choices. This woman is promoting that line.
Because I have two daughters and I don't need this happening in the world with them around. I don't ever want anyone getting them an abortion, and also it's just so sad that so many babies are dying and I want to do my part to help stop.
Did you catch that? Her assumption is that abortions are something inflicted on women and not chosen by them. To unwind this a little with regards to her daughters, the narrative is that women on their own would never choose sex for pleasure. It's assumed that this is something feminists and men bully them into. And it's assumed no woman would ever not want to have a baby. Again, it's assumed women aren't moral actors, but are just being led around by men. I can imagine that for a sex-phobic woman, the idea of her daughters growing up to be sexual beings who have abortions or could have abortions is intolerable, so she sticks to this extremely silly narrative. I will point out, however, she's protesting a doctor who performs abortions on women who often wanted their babies. I wonder if she realizes that what she is trying to do for her daughters is create a world where they could be condemned to death if they have a pregnancy that goes wrong. I guess anything, including death, is better than accepting that women are full human beings with moral agency.
I'd like to welcome Kathleen Berry to the program. Kathleen is a sociologist, an author, and a feminist activist with a long history in working in the fight against violence against women. Her new book is titled Unmaking War, Remaking Men: How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. She's here today to talk about masculinity, war, and her new book. Welcome to RealityCast, Kathleen.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you today.
So what inspired you to write a book about masculinity and war?
Actually, what inspired me, or maybe the opposite of inspired, was what angered me was the 2006 invasion of Lebanon by Israel. And as we had already were very used to watching footage of the war, U.S. war against Iraq, but somehow this constant reporting of the loss of innocent lives as I was watching this footage and the invasion of Israel, it started to really raise the question to me. If we say that it is wrong to kill some people, people we say have innocent lives, then we're implicitly and automatically saying it's okay to kill other people. Who are they? For the most part, they're men in combat. And that began my study of masculinity and war. Because although there are women, even in combat, the model, the military model for war is based on masculinity. And so I began to look at this subject across cultures, and of course, with the work that I've done on violence against women, was very familiar with this side of the question.
In the book, you describe violence, at least some of it, as what you call the blinding macho. Can you explain this concept?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. It occurred to me, as I was listening to soldiers who have been in combat talk about what goes on in combat, and as I was reading accounts and testimonies of it, that there's a fierce rage that is irrational, but very focused and very targeted and very specific, in that drives soldiers in combat. It's trained into them by the military. But the more I heard these accounts of what's actually going on when you're out in a firefight or something like that, the more it resonated for me with what I know of women's experience of violence in the home in particular, and the stories of wife abuse, of wife battery, from women who are facing men's irrational, driving anger, often fabricated, as it is often with soldiers, based on no real incident at all, or blowing up a small incident into a big thing, and a case in which men allow themselves, and I want to emphasize that there's agency here, men allow themselves to go out of control and go after the weaker and the more defenseless. And it became quite apparent to me 2 or 3 years into this study of masculinity in war that the same dynamic that's going on in wife abuse in the home is what's driving soldiers in combat, in firefights, when they're actually fighting, when they're going into people's homes to do house clearings. It's a blinding kind of rage that almost is enacted as if it's a privilege of masculinity to do it. I do it because I can. I can because I'm a man.
And do you feel like this mentality is mostly about the soldiers, or does it infect the people that are making the decisions to actually prosecute these wars?
Excellent question. These people making the decisions to put us into war, particularly the military generals, who are the ones I see making the decisions, not the president. He seems to be following their orders. These people have come up through those same ranks. They all went through basic training. They all learned to be remorseless killers, which is a goal of basic training in the military. To kill without remorse, without thinking, without turning back. These people become the ones who sit behind the desk and plan out the strategies for the soldiers who they have trained to enact. So they've come up through this whole system, the military system, and are really the responsible parties. I mean, I think anybody involved in harming another person or taking their lives is responsible. But there's another layer of responsibility for the generals and those in command who are really putting us in war and offering soldiers' lives for that purpose.
And one thing that's interesting to me is that there's this masculine socialization that is emphasized in basic training, and then the soldiers go to war, and then they come back, and they suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. How does this kind of masculine socialization relate to that? How does that feed into that?
Another really wonderful question, and a very, very important one. Masculinity, as it is taught and socialized and demanded of young men to become aggressive, to become fighters, to be able to do harm to other people. It turns out to be a kind of perversion of humanity, of our humanity. We have a common humanity. And in that common humanity, there's an impulse in human beings to not kill each other. And so we find, for soldiers, for example, if they're not really, really hardened by their training, a very bizarre reaction the first time they kill another human being. And so what I concluded is that the masculinity of war, which is the same as you brought up, is the masculinity of wife abuse, for example, are perversions of our humanity. They're not our humanity. They're not who we really are, which is why part of the title of the book is Remaking Men, because I think it's going to be very easy to do that when men are willing to give up the aggression that comes with learning masculinity, because our humanity is something that is deeper than all of that. So when we get to that humanity, we see that there's something larger than a clinical psychological diagnosis going on for those who have been have had post-traumatic stress disorder. That they have post-traumatic stress disorder because of what they've seen and what they've done. That is a violation of their own humanity. It goes deeper than a psychological problem. It is, as several soldiers, repeatedly I've heard this from soldiers, it's a violation of one's soul. You lose your soul, one soldier told me, the first time you kill another human being. And that harm is so deep and so profound. And yet, what I'm very hopeful about are these soldiers who are standing up and saying, I will not do that again, and walking away, and having, as there's an organization called the Courage to Resist, having the courage to resist that and turning around and starting to remake themselves and finding that some of these men are the strongest forces in the movement for peace today. So there's a very positive direction that can be seen out of all of this.
My guest today has been Kathleen Berry, and her book is called Unmaking War, Remaking Men: How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. You can find it online or in local bookstores. Her website is unmakingwar.net. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me. I've really appreciated talking with you. I got love for you if you were born in
the 80s, the 80s. Bill Donahue, the leader of a tiny organization called the Catholic League, should have never been taken seriously as a spokesman in the first place, something that should have been evident the first time you see his angry, embittered face on TV. But in case that wasn't obvious enough, then he should have been banned from being taken seriously the second he did this.
Here now is part of an ad that Bill Donahue's group placed. It was in the New York Times yesterday. It caught my eye as I was coming back to Atlanta to do this show. The Times continues to editorialize about the pedophilia crisis when all along it's been a homosexual crisis. Quote, 80% of the victims of priestly sexual abuse are male, and most of them are post-pubescent.
Yep, he used the grass on the field defense for raping children. I hear that's a popular one for men who cruise junior high schools for girls to abuse, and now Donahue has floated it for the priests whose victims had the misfortune of being, say, 12 or 13 instead of 10 or 11. These are not the words of a serious person who should ever be listened to again on any subject. But especially not on the subject of whether or not it's appropriate for the Smithsonian to host an exhibit where the topic of AIDS is broached. I'm guessing Donahue's overblown contempt for gay men puts him where the most mean-spirited conservatives were in 1983, which is believing people with AIDS are disgusting and deserve to die. And yet this man, who has gone out of his way to fight anyone who tries to get justice for the victims of rapist priests, has been listened to when it comes to his angry homophobic opinions on a new exhibit at the Smithsonian.
A Smithsonian exhibit that includes a video of ants crawling on a crucified Christ has triggered an unholy backlash. Catholic League President Bill Donahue blasted the museum's federal funding, saying the four-minute video was designed to insult and inflict injury and assault the sensibilities of Christians.
So, let's get this straight. In Donahue's world, art that depicts the suffering of AIDS victims by linking it to traditional Catholic imagery about the suffering of Christ is wrong and should be censored. But priests who sexually assault young teenagers shouldn't be distinguished in any way from regular gay men. Got it. It's nice to know that blatant hatred and bigotry like this is something the federal government still feels the need to cater to. By the way, the artist who did this piece that's causing all the outrage passed away from AIDS in 1992. But that doesn't protect him from accusations that he only did this kind of work about AIDS to offend the sensibilities of people like Donahue, who prefer AIDS victims to be silent as they shuffle off this mortal coil. I particularly love how he hides his hatred of gay men, and especially of AIDS victims, behind the "Christians are so offended" shtick. That really sets up who and who doesn't get to be offended, doesn't it? I'm offended at everyone who has blocked HIV relief and prevention efforts in the name of Jesus. I'm offended at everyone who tries to silence AIDS victims this way. And I'm offended while also being firmly in the anti-child rape camp. But my being offended doesn't amount to a hill of beans. Luckily, those folks on the side of art and compassion are not just rolling over for this one. Anti-censorship protesters gathered around the Transformer Gallery and held a protest.
I failed to see what anyone was objecting to. I mean, they were objecting to ants crawling on a crucifix. It's according to the reports, that just boggles my mind. Because you can go into the National Gallery of Art at any time and see, much more shocking depictions of crucifixes and Christ.
I would guess that it's because the offense has little to do with the crucifix and everything to do with the theme of the art, which is compassion for AIDS victims and rage at dying of AIDS. The Jesus stuff is just a cover story to attack AIDS victims, especially gay men. And of course, Glenn Beck had to get in on this whole thing.
Perfect storm. Eroding values. Hard work, sacrifice, thrift, honor, truth, God. As a nation born out of faith in God. How's that going today, huh?
Obviously, gay people or AIDS victims can't have values or work hard or be thrifty. Those are qualities that magically appear once you start putting a penis in a vagina.
And then you have the tax dollars funding this wonderful art display. It's Christmas at the Smithsonian. Here's this wonderful, oh look, it's Jesus with ants on him. They describe it as the first major museum exhibition to focus on the sexual difference in the making of modern American portraiture. What? You gotta be kidding me, right? What does this have to do with the birth of the baby Jesus? And why is he now covered in ants? Whose values are these?
So many lies in that short clip. First of all is the accusation that the Smithsonian is doing this as a Christmas exhibit. They're not. It's an exhibit that's lasting many months, and Christmas just happens to coincide with it. Museums, like the rest of the country that isn't in a shopping mall, continue to do the work they do year-round, even during Christmas. Then there's his suggestion that there's no way to understand what's going on in the exhibit when it's actually quite simple. So long as you don't throw a temper tantrum anytime someone asks you to think about something harder than how to find Fox News with your remote control. Then there's this lie about how this is being funded, which Beck claims in a graphic in the clip is by taxpayers. Actually, the exhibit is funded by private donations. But let's not let the facts get in the way. There's some hate and bigotry to be drummed up, and by gum, they're going to do it. I'll leave you with some thoughts from someone who actually bothered to see the exhibit.
Bit of a stir about it because a video that was part of the exhibit got removed by the curator because part of the video depicted a crucifix getting eaten by ants. It was created by an artist who died of AIDS, and it was supposed to convey what conservatives thought was ridicule for Christianity, but having seen the video, I think it actually was meant to convey the suffering of Jesus and how our sufferings can make us feel almost less than spiritual, can make us feel kind of trapped in these bodies in a way.
And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Damned If You Do, Damned If You Don't edition. There's never a good time for the sentiment that anti-feminist and anti-choicer Kate O'Byrne expressed on a panel, but it's especially ugly during a recession that's driven unemployment up to 10%.
The federal school lunch program, and now breakfast program, and I guess in Washington, D.C., dinner program, are pretty close to being sacred cows. Broad bipartisan support. And if we're going to ask more of ourselves, my question is, what poor excuse for a parent can't rustle up a bowl of cereal and a banana? I just don't get why millions of school children qualify for school breakfasts, unless we have a major widespread problem with child neglect. You know, I mean, if that many parents are incapable of pulling together a bowl of cereal and a banana, then we have problems that are way bigger than That problem can't be solved with a school breakfast because we have parents who are just criminally negligent with respect to raising children.
In Kate O'Byrne's ideal world, you would be forced to bear children if you got pregnant, no matter how little you felt you could afford it. And then, after she forces you to have children you can't afford, she's going to call you a child abuser if you need help that you knew that you needed. If you buy this logic, it makes sense to starve innocent children, I suppose. The logic being, screw the poor, that is.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.